This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Woman Warrior, Memoirs of a Girlhood Among Ghosts, written by Maxine Hong Kingston, narrated by Ming Na.
No name woman. You must not tell anyone, my mother said, what I am about to tell you. In China, your father had a sister who killed herself. She jumped into the family well. We say that your father has all brothers because it is as if she had never been born. In 1924, just a few days after our village celebrated 17 hurry-up weddings, to make sure that every young man who went out on the road would responsibly come home, your father and his brothers and your grandfather and his brothers and your aunt's new husband sailed for America, the Gold Mountain. It was your grandfather's last trip. Those lucky enough to get contracts waved goodbye from the decks. They fed and guarded the stowaways and helped them off in Cuba, New York, Bali, Hawaii. We'll meet in California next year, they said. All of them sent money home. I remember looking at your aunt one day when she and I were dressing. I had not noticed before that she had such a protruding melon of a stomach. But I did not think she's pregnant. Until she began to look like other pregnant women, her shirt pulling and the white tops of her black pants showing. She could not have been pregnant, you see, because her husband had been gone for years. No one said anything. We did not discuss it. In early summer, she was ready to have the child, long after the time when it could have been possible. The village had also been counting. On the night the baby was to be born, the villagers raided our house. Some were crying. Like a great saw, teeth strung with lights, files of people walked zigzag across our land, tearing the rice. Their lanterns doubled in the disturbed black water, which drained away through the broken buns. As the villagers closed in, we could see that some of them, probably men and women we knew well, wore white masks. The people with long hair hung it over their faces. Women with short hair made it stand up on end. Some had tied white bands around their foreheads, arms, and legs. At first, they threw mud and rocks at the house. Then they threw eggs and began slaughtering our stock. We could hear the animals scream their deaths, the roosters, the pigs, a last great roar from the ox. Familiar wild heads flared in our night windows. The villagers encircled us. Some of the faces stopped to peer at us, their eyes rushing like searchlights. The hands flattened against the panes, framed heads, and left red prints. The villagers broke in the front and the back doors at the same time, even though we had not locked the doors against them. Their knives dripped with the blood of our animals. They smeared blood on the doors and walls. One woman swung a chicken whose throat she had slit, splattering blood in red arcs about her. We stood together in the middle of our house, in the family hall with the pictures and tables of the ancestors around us, and looked straight ahead. At that time, the house had only two wings. When the men came back, we would build two more to enclose our courtyard and a third one to begin a second courtyard. The villagers pushed through both wings, even your grandparents' room, to find your aunt's, which was also mine, until the men returned. From this room, a new wing for one of the younger families would grow. They ripped up her clothes and shoes and broke her combs, grinding them underfoot. They tore her work from the loom. They scattered the cooking fire and rolled the new weaving in it. We could hear them in the kitchen breaking our bowls and banging the pots. They overturned the great waist-high earthenware jugs. Duck eggs, pickled fruits, vegetables burst out and mixed in acrid torrents. The old woman from the next field swept a broom through the air and loosed the spirits of the broom over our heads. Pig! Ghost! Pig! They sobbed and scolded while they ruined our house. When they left, they took sugar and oranges to bless themselves. They cut pieces from the dead animals. Some of them took bowls that were not broken and clothes that were not torn. Afterward, we swept up the rice and sewed it back up into sacks. But the smells from the spilled preserves lasted. Your aunt gave birth in the pigsty that night. The next morning when I went for the water, I found her and the baby plugging up the family well. Don't let your father know that I told you. He denies her. Now that you have started to menstruate, what happened to her could happen to you. Don't humiliate us. You wouldn't like to be forgotten as if you had never been born. The villagers are watchful. Whenever she had to warn us about life, my mother told stories that ran like this one, a story to grow up on. She tested our strength to establish realities. Those in the immigrant generations who could not reassert brute survival died young and far from home. Those of us in the first American generations have had to figure out how the invisible world the immigrants built around our childhoods fits in solid America. The immigrants confuse the gods by diverting the curses, misleading them with crooked streets and false names. They must try to confuse their offspring as well, who, I suppose, threaten them in similar ways, always trying to get things straight, always trying to name the unspeakable. The Chinese I know hide their names. Sojourners take new names when their lives change and guard their real names with silence. Chinese Americans, when you try to understand what things in you are Chinese, how do you separate what is peculiar to childhood, to poverty, insanities, one family, your mother who marked your growing with stories, from what is Chinese? What is Chinese tradition and what is in the movies? If I want to learn what clothes my aunt wore, whether flashy or ordinary, I would have to begin. Remember father's drowned in the well, sister? I cannot ask that. My mother has told me once and for all the useful parts. She will add nothing unless powered by necessity, a riverbank that guides her life. She plants vegetable gardens rather than lawns. She carries the odd-shaped tomatoes home from the fields and eats food left for the gods. Whenever we did frivolous things, we used up energy. We flew high kites. We children came up off the ground over the melting cones our parents brought home from work and the American movie on New Year's Day. Oh, you beautiful doll with Betty Grable one year, and she wore a yellow ribbon with John Wayne another year. After the one carnival ride each, we paid in guilt. Our tired father counted his change on the dark walk home. Adultery is extravagance. Could people who hatch their own chicks and eat the embryos and the heads for delicacies and boil the feet in vinegar for party food, leaving only the gravel, eating even the gizzard lining, could such people engender a prodigal aunt? To be a woman, to have a daughter in starvation time, was a waste enough. My aunt could not have been the lone romantic who gave up everything for sex. Women in the old China did not choose. Some man had commanded her to lie with him and be his secret evil. I wonder whether he masked himself when he joined the raid on her family. Perhaps she had encountered him in the fields or on the mountains where the daughters-in-law collected fuel. Or perhaps he first noticed her in the marketplace. He was not a stranger because the village housed no strangers. She had to have dealings with him other than sex. Perhaps he worked an adjoining field, or he sold her the cloth for the dress she sewed and wore. His demand must have surprised, then terrified her. She obeyed him. She always did as she was told. When the family found a young man in the next village to be her husband, she had stood tractably beside the best rooster, his proxy, and promised before they met that she would be his forever. She was lucky that he was her age, and she would be the first wife, an advantage secure now. The night she first saw him, he had sex with her. Then he left for America. She had almost forgotten what he looked like. When she tried to envision him, she only saw the black and white face in the group photograph the men had had taken before leaving. The other man was not, after all, much different from her husband. They both gave orders. She followed.
If you tell your family, I'll beat you. I'll kill you. Be here again next week.
No one talks sex, ever. And she might have separated the rapes from the rest of living, if only she did not have to buy her oil from him or gather wood in the same forest. I want her fear to have lasted just as long as rape lasted, so that the fear could have been contained. No drawn-out fear. But women at sex hazarded birth and hence lifetimes. The fear did not stop but permeated everywhere. She told the man, "I think I'm pregnant." He organized the raid against her. On nights when my mother and father talked about their life back home, sometimes they mentioned an outcast table, whose business they still seemed to be settling, their voices tight. In a commensal tradition where food is precious, the powerful older people made wrongdoers eat alone. Instead of letting them start separate new lives like the Japanese, who could become samurais and geishas, the Chinese family, faces averted but eyes glowering sideways, hung on to the offenders and fed them leftovers. My aunt must have lived in the same house as my parents and eaten at an outcast table. My mother spoke about the raid as if she had seen it, when she and my aunt, a daughter-in-law to a different household, should not have been living together at all. Daughters-in-law lived with their husband's parents, not their own. A synonym for marriage in Chinese is taking a daughter-in-law. Her husband's parents could have sold her, mortgaged her, stoned her, but they had sent her back to her own mother and father, a mysterious act hinting at disgraces not told me. Perhaps they had thrown her out to deflect the Avengers. She was the only daughter. Her four brothers went with her father, husband, and uncles out on the road and, for some years, became Western men. When the goods were divided among the family, three of the brothers took land and the youngest, my father, chose an education. After my grandparents gave their daughter away to her husband's family, they had dispensed all the adventure and all the property. They expected her alone to keep the traditional ways, which her brothers, now among the barbarians, could fumble without detection. The heavy, deep-rooted women were to maintain the past against the flood, safe for returning. But the rare urge West had fixed upon our family, and so my aunt crossed boundaries not delineated in space. The work of preservation demands that the feelings playing about in one's guts not be turned into action. Just watch their passing like cherry blossoms. But perhaps my aunt, my forerunner, caught in a slow life, let dreams grow and fade, and after some months or years, went toward what persisted. Fear at the enormities of the forbidden kept her desires delicate, wire and bone. She looked at a man because she liked the way the hair was tucked behind his ears, or she liked the question mark line of a long torso curving at the shoulder and straight at the hip. For warm eyes or a soft voice or a slow walk, that's all. A few hairs, a line, a brightness, a sound, a pace. She gave up family. She offered us up for a charm that vanished with tiredness, a pigtail that didn't toss when the wind died. Why, the wrong lighting could erase the dearest thing about him. It could very well have been, however, that my aunt did not take subtle enjoyment of her friend, but a wild woman kept rollicking company. Imagining her free with sex doesn't fit, though. I don't know any women like that, or men, either. Unless I see her life branching into mine, she gives me no ancestral help. To sustain her being in love, she often worked at herself in the mirror, guessing at the colors and shapes that would interest him, changing them frequently in order to hit on the right combination. She wanted him to look back. On a farm near the sea, a woman who tended her appearance reaped a reputation for eccentricity. All the married women blunt cut their hair in flaps about their ears or pulled it back in tight buns. No nonsense. Neither style blew easily into heart-catching tangles. And at their weddings, they displayed themselves in their long hair for the last time. "It brushed the backs of my knees," my mother tells me. "It was braided, and even so, it brushed the backs of my knees." At the mirror, my aunt combed individuality into her bob. A bun could have been contrived to escape into black streamers blowing in the wind, or in quiet wisps about her face. But only the older women in our picture album wore buns. She brushed her hair back from her forehead, tucking the flaps behind her ears. She looped a piece of thread, knotted into a circle between her index fingers and thumbs, and ran the double strand across her forehead. When she closed her fingers as if she were making a pair of shadow geese bite, the string twisted together, catching the little hairs. Then she pulled the thread away from her skin, ripping the hairs out neatly, her eyes watering from the needles of pain. Opening her fingers, she cleaned the thread, then rolled it along her hairline and the tops of her eyebrows. My mother did the same to me and my sisters and herself. I used to believe that the expression "caught by the short hairs" meant a captive held with a depilatory string. It especially hurt at the temples, but my mother said we were lucky we didn't have to have our feet bound when we were 7. Sisters used to sit on their beds and cry together, she said, as their mothers or their slaves removed the bandages for a few minutes each night and let the blood gush back into their veins. I hope that the man my aunt loved appreciated a smooth brow, that he wasn't just a tits-and-ass man. Once my aunt found a freckle on her chin, at a spot that the almanac said predestined her for unhappiness. She dug at it with a hot needle and washed the wound with peroxide. More attention to her looks than these pullings of hairs and pickings at spots would have caused gossip among the villagers. They owned work clothes and good clothes, and they wore good clothes for feasting the new seasons. But since a woman combing her hair hexes beginnings, my aunt rarely found an occasion to look her best. Women looked like great sea snails. The corded wood, babies, and laundry they carried were the whirls on their backs. The Chinese did not admire a bent back. Goddesses and warriors stood straight. Still, there must have been a marvelous freeing of beauty when a worker laid down her burden and stretched and arched. Such commonplace loveliness, however, was not enough for my aunt. She dreamed of a lover for the 15 days of New Year's, the time for families to exchange visits, money, and food. She plied her secret comb. And sure enough, she cursed the year, the family, the village, and herself. Even as her hair lured her imminent lover, many other men looked at her. Uncles, cousins, nephews, brothers would have looked too, had they been home between journeys. Perhaps they had already been restraining their curiosity, and they left, fearful that their glances, like a field of nesting birds, might be startled and caught. Poverty hurt, and that was their first reason for leaving. But another, final reason for leaving the crowded house was the never said. She may have been unusually beloved, the precious only daughter, spoiled and mirror-gazing because of the affection the family lavished on her. When her husband left, they welcomed the chance to take her back from the in-laws. She could live like the little daughter for just a while longer. There are stories that my grandfather was different from other people, crazy ever since the little Jap bayoneted him in the head. He used to put his naked penis on the dinner table, laughing. And one day, he brought home a baby girl, wrapped up inside his brown Western-style greatcoat. He had traded one of his sons, probably my father, the youngest, for her. My grandmother made him trade back. When he finally got a daughter of his own, he doted on her. They must have all loved her, except perhaps my father, the only brother who never went back to China, having once been traded for a girl. Brothers and sisters, newly men and women, had to efface their sexual color and present plain miens. Disturbing hair and eyes, a smile like no other, threatened the ideal of five generations living under one roof. To focus blurs, people shouted face to face and yelled from room to room. The immigrants I know have loud voices, unmodulated to American tones even after years away from the village where they called their friendships out across the fields. I have not been able to stop my mother's screams in public libraries or over telephones. Walking erect, knees straight, toes pointed forward, not pigeon-toed, which is Chinese feminine, and speaking in an inaudible voice, I have tried to turn myself American feminine. Chinese communication was loud, public. Only sick people had to whisper. But at the dinner table, where the family members came nearest one another, no one could talk, not the outcasts, nor any eaters. Every word that falls from the mouth is a coin lost. Silently, they gave and accepted food with both hands. A preoccupied child who took his bowl with one hand got a sideways glare. A complete moment of total attention is due everyone alike. Children and lovers have no singularity here, but my aunt used a secret voice, a separate attentiveness. She kept the man's name to herself throughout her labor and dying. She did not accuse him that he be punished with her. To save her inseminator's name, she gave silent birth. He may have been somebody in her own household, but intercourse with a man outside the family would have been no less abhorrent. All the village were kinsmen, and the title shouted in loud country voices, "Never let kinship be forgotten." Any man within visiting distance would have been neutralized as a lover, brother, younger brother, older brother. 115 relationship titles. Parents research birth charts, probably not so much to assure good fortune as to circumvent incest in a population that has but 100 surnames. Everybody has 8 million relatives. How useless, then, sexual mannerisms. How dangerous. As if it came from an atavism deeper than fear, I used to add brother silently to boys' names. It hexed the boys who would or would not ask me to dance and made them less scary and as familiar and deserving of benevolence as girls. But of course, I hexed myself also. No dates. I should have stood up, both arms waving, and shouted out across libraries, "Hey, you! Love me back!" I had no idea, though, how to make attraction selective, how to control its direction and magnitude. If I made myself American pretty so that the 5 or 6 Chinese boys in the class fell in love with me, everyone else, the Caucasian, Negro, and Japanese boys would too. Sisterliness, dignified and honorable, made much more sense. Attraction eludes control so stubbornly that whole societies designed to organize relationships among people cannot keep order, not even when they bind people to one another from childhood and raise them together. Among the very poor and the wealthy, brothers married their adopted sisters, like doves. Our family allowed some romance, paying adult brides' prices and providing dowries so that their sons and daughters could marry strangers. Marriage promises to turn strangers into friendly relatives, a nation of siblings. In the village structure, spirits shimmered among the live creatures, balanced and held in equilibrium by time and land. But one human being flaring up into violence could open up a black hole, a maelstrom that pulled in the sky. The frightened villagers, who depended on one another to maintain the real, went to my aunt to show her a personal, physical representation of the break she had made in the roundness. Misaligned couples snapped off the future, which was to be embodied in true offspring. The villagers punished her for acting as if she could have a private life, secret and apart from them. If my aunt had betrayed the family at a time of large grain yields and peace, when many boys were born and wings were being built on many houses, perhaps she might have escaped such severe punishment. But the men, hungry, greedy, tired of planting in dry soil, had been forced to leave the village in order to send food money home. There were ghost plagues, bandit plagues, wars with the Japanese, floods. My Chinese brother and sister had died of an unknown sickness. Adultery, perhaps only a mistake during good times, became a crime when the village needed food. The round mooncakes and round doorways, the round tables of graduated sizes that fit one roundness inside another, round windows and rice bowls, these talismans had lost their power to warn this family of the law. A family must be whole, faithfully keeping the descent line by having sons to feed the old and the dead, who in turn look after the family. The villagers came to show my aunt and her lover in hiding a broken house. The villagers were speeding up the circling of events because she was too short-sighted to see that her infidelity had already harmed the village, that waves of consequences would return unpredictably, sometimes in disguise as now, to hurt her. This roundness had to be made coin-sized so that she would see its circumference. Punish her at the birth of her baby. Awaken her to the inexorable. People who refused fatalism because they could invent small resources insisted on culpability. Deny accidents and wrest fault from the stars. After the villagers left, their lanterns now scattering in various directions toward home, the family broke their silence and cursed her. Hey-ya! We're going to die. Death is coming. Death is coming. Look what you've done. You've killed us. Ghost. Dead ghost. Ghost. You've never been born. She ran out into the fields far enough from the house so that she could no longer hear their voices and pressed herself against the earth, her own land, no more. When she felt the birth coming, she thought that she had been hurt. Her body seized together. They've hurt me too much, she thought. This is gall, and it will kill me. With forehead and knees against the earth, her body convulsed and then relaxed. She turned on her back, lay on the ground. The black well of sky and stars went out and out and out forever. Her body and her complexity seemed to disappear. She was one of the stars, a bright dot in blackness, without home, without a companion, in eternal cold and silence. An agoraphobia rose in her, speeding higher and higher, bigger and bigger. She would not be able to contain it. There would be no end to fear. Flayed, unprotected against space, she felt pain return, focusing her body. This pain chilled her, a cold, steady kind of surface pain. Inside, spasmodically, the other pain, the pain of the child, heated her. For hours she lay on the ground, alternately body and space. Sometimes a vision of normal comfort obliterated reality. She saw the family in the evening gambling at the dinner table, the young people massaging their elders' backs. She saw them congratulating one another, high joy on the mornings the rice shoots came up. When these pictures burst, the stars drew yet further apart. Black space opened. She got to her feet to fight better and remembered that old-fashioned women gave birth in their pigsties to fool the jealous, pain-stealing gods who did not snatch piglets. Before the next spasms could stop her, she ran to the pigsty, each step a rushing out into emptiness. She climbed over the fence and knelt in the dirt. It was good to have a fence enclosing her, a tribal person alone. Laboring, this woman who had carried her child as a foreign growth that sickened her every day, expelled it at last. She reached down to touch the hot, wet, moving mass, surely smaller than anything human, and could feel that It was human, after all. Fingers, toes, nails, nose. She pulled it up onto her belly, and it lay curled there, butt in the air, feet precisely tucked one under the other. She opened her loose shirt and buttoned the child inside. After resting, it squirmed and thrashed, and she pushed it up to her breast. It turned its head this way and that until it found her nipple. There, it made little snuffling noises. She clenched her teeth at its preciousness. Lovely as a young calf, a piglet, a little dog. She may have gone to the pigsty as a last act of responsibility. She would protect this child as she had protected its father. It would look after her soul, leaving supplies on her grave. But how would this tiny child without family find her grave when there would be no marker for her anywhere, neither in the earth nor the family hall? No one would give her a family hall name. She had taken the child with her into the wastes. At its birth, the two of them had felt the same raw pain of separation, a wound that only the family pressing tight could close. A child with no descent line would not soften her life, but only trail after her, ghost-like, begging her to give it purpose. At dawn, the villagers on their way to the fields would stand around the fence and look. Full of milk, the little ghost slept. When it awoke, she hardened her breasts against the milk that crying loosens. Toward morning, she picked up the baby and walked to the well. Carrying the baby to the well shows loving, otherwise abandon it. Turn its face into the mud. Mothers who love their children take them along. It was probably a girl. There is some hope of forgiveness for boys. Don't tell anyone you had an aunt. Your father does not want to hear her name. She has never been born. I have believed that sex was unspeakable and words so strong and father so frail that aunt would do my father mysterious harm. I have thought that my family, having settled among immigrants who had also been their neighbors in the ancestral land, needed to clean their name, and a wrong word would incite the kinspeople even here. But there is more to this silence. They want me to participate in her punishment. And I have. In the 20 years since I heard this story, I have not asked for details, nor said my aunt's name. I do not know it. People who can comfort the dead can also chase after them to hurt them further. A reverse ancestor worship. The real punishment was not the raid swiftly inflicted by the villagers, but the families deliberately forgetting her. Her betrayal so maddened them, they saw to it that she would suffer forever, even after death. Always hungry, always needing, she would have to beg food from other ghosts, snatch and steal it from those whose living descendants gave them gifts. She would have to fight the ghosts, massed at crossroads for the buns a few thoughtful citizens leave, to decoy her away from village and home so that the ancestral spirits could feast unharassed. At peace, they could act like gods, not ghosts, their descent lines providing them with paper suits and dresses, spirit money, paper houses, paper automobiles, chicken, meat, and rice into eternity. Essences delivered up in smoke and flames, steam and incense rising from each rice bowl. In an attempt to make the Chinese care for people outside the family, Chairman Mao encourages us now to give our paper replicas to the spirits of outstanding soldiers and workers, no matter whose ancestors they may be. My aunt remains forever hungry. Goods are not distributed evenly among the dead. My aunt haunts me. Her ghost drawn to me because now, after 50 years of neglect, I alone devote pages of paper to her, though not origamied into houses and clothes. I do not think she always means me well. I'm telling on her. And she was a spite suicide, drowning herself in the drinking water. The Chinese are always very frightened of the drowned one, whose weeping ghost, wet hair hanging and skin bloated, waits silently by the water to pull down a substitute. White Tigers. When we Chinese girls listen to the adults talk story, we learn that we failed if we grew up to be but wives or slaves. We could be heroines, swordswomen. Even if she had to rage across all China, a swordswoman got even with anybody who hurt her family. Perhaps women were once so dangerous that they had to have their feet bound. It was a woman who invented white crane boxing only 200 years ago. She was already an expert pole fighter, daughter of a teacher trained at the Shaolin Temple, where there lived an order of fighting monks. She was combing her hair one morning when a white crane alighted outside her window. She teased it with her pole, which it pushed aside with a soft brush of its wing. Amazed, she dashed outside and tried to knock the crane off its perch. It snapped her pole in two. Recognizing the presence of great power, she asked the spirit of the white crane if it would teach her to fight. It answered with a cry that white crane boxers imitate today. Later, the bird returned as an old man, and he guided her boxing for many years. Thus, she gave the world a new martial art. This was one of the tamer, more modern stories, mere introduction. My mother told others that followed swordswomen through woods and palaces for years. Night after night, my mother would talk story until we fell asleep. I couldn't tell where the stories left off and the dreams began, her voice the voice of the heroines in my sleep. And on Sundays from noon to midnight, we went to the movies at the Confucius Church. We saw swordswomen jump over houses from a standstill. They didn't even need a running start. At last, I saw that I, too, had been in the presence of great power, my mother talking story. After I grew up, I heard the chant of Fa Mulan, the girl who took her father's place in battle. Instantly, I remembered that as a child, I had followed my mother about the house, the two of us singing about how Fa Mulan fought gloriously and returned alive from war to settle in the village. I had forgotten this chant that was once mine, given me by my mother, who may not have known its power to remind. She said I would grow up a wife and a slave, but she taught me the song of the warrior woman, Fa Mulan. I would have to grow up a warrior woman. The call would come from a bird that flew over our roof. In the brush drawings, it looks like the ideograph for human, two black wings. The bird would cross the sun and lift into the mountains, which looked like the ideograph mountain, there parting the mist briefly that swirled opaque again. I would be a little girl of 7 the day I followed the bird away into the mountains. The brambles would tear off my shoes and the rocks cut my feet and fingers, but I would keep climbing, eyes upward to follow the bird. We would go around and around the tallest mountain, climbing ever upward. I would drink from the river, which I would meet again and again. We would go so high the plants would change, and the river that flows past the village would become a waterfall. At the height where the bird used to disappear, the clouds would gray the world like an ink wash. Even when I got used to that gray, I would only see peaks as if shaded in pencil, rocks like charcoal rubbings, everything so murky. There would be just two black strokes, the bird. Inside the clouds, inside the dragon's breath, I would not know how many hours or days passed. Suddenly, without noise, I would break clear into a yellow, warm world. New trees would lean toward me at mountain angles, but when I looked for the village, it would have vanished under the clouds. The bird, now gold, so close to the sun, would come to rest on the thatch of a hut, which until the bird's 2 feet touched it, was camouflaged as part of the mountainside. The door opened and an old man and an old woman came out carrying bowls of rice and soup and a leafy branch of peaches.
Have you eaten rice today, little girl? They greeted me.
Yes, I have, I said out of politeness. Thank you. No, I haven't, I would have said in real life, mad at the Chinese for lying so much. I'm starved. Do you have any cookies? I like chocolate chip cookies.
We were about to sit down to another meal, the old woman said. Why don't you eat with us?
They just happened to be bringing 3 rice bowls and 3 pairs of silver chopsticks out to the plank table under the pines. They gave me an egg as if it were my birthday and tea, though they were older than I, but I poured for them. The teapot and the rice pot seemed bottomless, but perhaps not. The old couple ate very little except for peaches. When the mountains and the pines turned into blue oxen, blue dogs, and blue people standing, the old couple asked me to spend the night in the hut. I thought about the long way down in the ghostly dark and decided yes. The inside of the hut seemed as large as the outdoors. Pine needles covered the floor in thick patterns. Someone had carefully arranged the yellow, green, and brown pine needles according to age. When I stepped carelessly and mussed a line, my feet kicked up new blends of earth colors. But the old man and old woman walked so lightly that their feet never stirred the designs by a needle. A rock grew in the middle of the house, and that was their table. The benches were fallen trees. Ferns and shade flowers grew out of one wall, the mountainside itself. The old couple tucked me into a bed just my width.
"Breathe evenly, or you'll lose your balance and fall out," said the woman, covering me with a silk bag stuffed with feathers and herbs. "Opera singers, who begin their training at age 5, sleep in beds like this."
Then the two of them went outside, and through the window I could see them pull on a rope looped over a branch. The rope was tied to the roof, and the roof opened up like a basket lid. I would sleep with the moon and the stars. I did not see whether the old people slept, so quickly did I drop off, but they would be there waking me with food in the morning.
Little girl, you have now spent almost a day and a night with us, the old woman said.
In the morning light, I could see her earlobes pierced with gold.
Do you think you can bear to stay with us for 15 years? We can train you to become a warrior.
What about my mother and father? I asked. The old man untied the drinking gourd slung across his back. He lifted the lid by its stem and looked for something in the water.
Ah, there, he said.
At first I saw only water so clear it magnified the fibers in the walls of the gourd. On the surface I saw only my own round reflection. The old man encircled the neck of the gourd with his thumb and index finger and gave it a shake. As the water shook, then settled, the colors and lights shimmered into a picture, not reflecting anything I could see around me. There, at the bottom of the gourd, were my mother and father scanning the sky, which was where I was.
It has happened already, then, I could hear my mother say. I didn't expect it so soon.
You knew from her birth that she would be taken, my father answered.
We'll have to harvest potatoes without her help this year, my mother said, and they turned away toward the fields, straw baskets in their arms. The water shook and became just water again. Mama, Baba, I called. But they were in the valley and could not hear me.
What do you want to do? The old man asked. You can go back right now if you like. You can go pull sweet potatoes. Or you can stay with us and learn to fight barbarians and bandits.
You can avenge your village, said the old woman. You can recapture the harvest the thieves have taken. You can be remembered by the Han people for your dutifulness.
I'll stay with you, I said. So the hut became my home. And I found out that the old woman did not arrange the pine needles by hand. She opened the roof. An autumn wind would come up, and the needles fell in braids, brown strands, green strands, yellow strands.
The old woman waved her arms in conducting motions. She blew softly with her mouth. I thought, nature certainly works differently on mountains than in valleys.
The first thing you have to learn, the old woman told me, is how to be quiet.
They left me by streams to watch for animals.
If you're noisy, you'll make the deer go without water.
When I could kneel all day without my legs cramping and my breathing became even, the squirrels would bury their hoardings at the hem of my shirt and then bend their tails in a celebration dance. At night, the mice and toads looked at me, their eyes quick stars and slow stars. Not once would I see a three-legged toad, though. You need strings of cash to bait them. The two old people led me in exercises that began at dawn and ended at sunset, so that I could watch our shadows grow and shrink and grow again, rooted to the earth. I learned to move my fingers, hands, feet, head, and entire body in circles. I walked, putting heel down first, toes pointed outward 30 to 40 degrees, making the ideograph 8, making the ideograph human. Knees bent, I would swing into the slow, measured square step, the powerful walk into battle. After 5 years, my body became so strong that I could control even the dilations of the pupils inside my irises. I could copy owls and bats, the words for bat and blessing homonyms. After 6 years, the deer let me run beside them. I could jump 20 feet into the air from a standstill, leaping like a monkey over the hut. Every creature has a hiding skill and a fighting skill a warrior can use. When birds alighted on my palm, I could yield my muscles under their feet and give them no base from which to fly away. But I could not fly like the bird that led me here, except in large, free dreams. During the 7th year, I would be 14. The two old people led me blindfolded to the mountains of the white tigers. They held me by either elbow and shouted into my ears, "Run, run, run!" I ran, and not stepping off a cliff at the edge of my toes or not hitting my forehead against a wall, ran faster. The wind buoyed me up over the roots, the rocks, the little hills. We reached the tiger place in no time, a mountain peak 3 feet 3 from the sky. We had to bend over. The old people waved once, slid down the mountain, and disappeared around a tree. The old woman, good with the bow and arrow, took them with her. The old man took the water gourd. I would have to survive barehanded. Snow lay on the ground, and snow fell in loose gusts, another way the dragon breathes. I walked in the direction from which we had come, and when I reached the timberline, I collected wood broken from the cherry tree, the peony, and the walnut, which is the tree of life. Fire, the old people had taught me, is stored in trees that grow red flowers or red berries in the spring, or whose leaves turn red in the fall. I took the wood from the protected spots beneath the trees and wrapped it in my scarf to keep dry. I dug where squirrels might have come, stealing one or two nuts at each place. These I also wrapped in my scarf. It is possible, the old people said, for a human being to live for 50 days on water. I would save the roots and nuts for hard climbs, the places where nothing grew, the emergency should I not find the hut. This time, there would be no bird to follow. The first night, I burned half the wood and slept curled against the mountain. I heard the white tigers prowling on the other side of the fire, but I could not distinguish them from the snow patches. The morning rose perfectly. I hurried along, again collecting wood and edibles. I ate nothing and only drank the snow my fires made run. The first 2 days were gifts, the fasting so easy to do, I so smug in my strength that on the 3rd day, the hardest, I caught myself sitting on the ground, opening the scarf and staring at the nuts and dry roots. Instead of walking steadily on or even eating, I faded into dreams about the meat meals my mother used to cook, my monk's food forgotten. That night, I burned up most of the wood I had collected, unable to sleep for facing my death. If not death here, then death someday. The moon animals that did not hibernate came out to hunt, but I had given up the habits of a carnivore since living with the old people. I would not trap the mice that danced so close or the owls that plunged just outside the fire. On the fourth and fifth days, my eyesight sharp with hunger, I saw deer and used their trails when our ways coincided. Where the deer nibbled, I gathered the fungus of immortality. At noon on the tenth day, I packed snow, white as rice, into the worn center of a rock pointed out to me by a finger of ice, and around the rock I built a fire. In the warming water I put roots, nuts, and the fungus of immortality. For variety, I ate a quarter of the nuts and roots raw. Oh, green, joyous rush inside my mouth, my head, my stomach, my toes, my soul. The best meal of my life. One day I found that I was striding long distances without hindrance, my bundle light. Food had become so scarce that I was no longer stopping to collect it. I had walked into deadland. Here, even the snow stopped. I did not go back to the richer areas where I could not stay anyway, but resolving to fast until I got halfway to the next woods, I started across the dry rocks. Heavily weighed down by the wood on my back, branches poking maddeningly, I had burned almost all of the fuel not to waste strength lugging it. Somewhere in the deadland, I lost count of the days. It seemed as if I had been walking forever. Life had never been different from this. An old man and an old woman were help I had only wished for. I was 14 years old and lost from my village. I was walking in circles. Hadn't I been already found by the old people? Or was that yet to come? I wanted my mother and father. The old man and old woman were only a part of this lostness and this hunger. One nightfall, I ate the last of my food but had enough sticks for a good fire. I stared into the flames, which reminded me about helping my mother with the cooking, and made me cry. It was very strange looking through water into fire and seeing my mother again. I nodded, orange and warm. A white rabbit hopped beside me, and for a moment I thought it was a blob of snow that had fallen out of the sky. The rabbit and I studied each other. Rabbits taste like chickens. My mother and father had taught me how to hit rabbits over the head with wine jugs, then skin them cleanly for fur vests. "It's a cold night to be an animal," I said. "So you want some fire too, do you? Let me put on another branch, then." I would not hit it with the branch. I had learned from rabbits to kick backward. Perhaps this one was sick because normally the animals did not like fire. The rabbit seemed alert enough, however, looking at me so acutely, bounding up to the fire. But it did not stop when it got to the edge. It turned its face once toward me, then jumped into the fire. The fire went down for a moment, as if crouching in surprise. Then the flames shot up taller than before. When the fire became calm again, I saw the rabbit had turned into meat, browned just right. I ate it, knowing the rabbit had sacrificed itself for me. It had made me a gift of meat. When you have been walking through trees hour after hour, and I finally reached trees after the deadland, branches cross out everything, no relief whichever way your head turns until your eyes start to invent new sights. Hunger also changes the world. When eating can't be a habit, then neither can seeing. I saw two people made of gold dancing the earth's dances. They turned so perfectly that together they were the axis of the earth's turning. They were light. They were molten, changing gold. Chinese lion dancers, African lion dancers in mid-step. I heard high Javanese bells deepen in mid-ring to Indian bells, Hindu-Indian, American-Indian. Before my eyes, gold bells shredded into gold tassels that fanned into two royal capes that softened into lion's fur. Manes grew tall into feathers that shone, became light rays. Then the dancers danced the future a machine future in clothes that I had never seen before. I am watching the centuries pass in moments because suddenly I understand time, which is spinning and fixed like the North Star. And I understand how working and hoeing are dancing, how peasant clothes are golden, as king's clothes are golden, how one of the dancers is always a man and the other a woman. The man and the woman grow bigger and bigger, so bright, all light. They are tall angels in two rows. They have high white wings on their backs. Perhaps there are infinite angels. Perhaps I see two angels in their consecutive moments. I cannot bear their brightness and cover my eyes, which hurt from opening so wide without a blink. When I put my hands down to look again, I recognize the old brown man and the old gray woman walking toward me out of the pine forest. It would seem that this small crack in the mystery was opened, not so much by the old people's magic as by hunger. Afterward, whenever I did not eat for long, as during famine or battle, I could stare at ordinary people and see their light and gold. I could see their dance. When I get hungry enough, then killing and falling are dancing too. The old people fed me hot vegetable soup. Then they asked me to talk story about what happened in the mountains of the white tigers. I told them that the white tigers had stalked me through the snow, but that I had fought them off with burning branches, and my great-grandparents had come to lead me safely through the forests. I had met a rabbit that taught me about self-immolation and how to speed up transmigration. One does not have to become worms first, but can change directly into a human being. As in our own humanness, we had just changed bowls of vegetable soup into people, too. That made them laugh.
"You tell good stories," they said. "Now go to sleep, and tomorrow we will begin your dragon lessons."
"One more thing," I wanted to say. "I saw you, and how old you really are." But I was already asleep. It came out only a murmur. I would want to tell them about that last moment of my journey, but it was only one moment out of the weeks that I had been gone, and its telling would keep till morning. Besides, the two people must already know. In the next years, when I suddenly came upon them, or when I caught them out of the corners of my eyes, he appeared as a handsome young man, tall with long black hair, and she as a beautiful young woman who ran bare-legged through the trees. In the spring, she dressed like a bride. She wore juniper leaves in her hair and a black embroidered jacket. I learned to shoot accurately because my teachers held the targets. Often, when sighting along an arrow, there to the side, I would glimpse the young man or young woman. But when I looked directly, he or she would be old again. By this time, I had guessed from their manner that the old woman was to the old man a sister or a friend rather than a wife. After I returned from my survival test, the two old people trained me in dragon ways, which took another 8 years. Copying the tigers, their stalking kill, and their anger had been a wild, bloodthirsty joy. Tigers are easy to find, but I need adult wisdom to know dragons.
"You have to infer the whole dragon from the parts you can see and touch," the old people would say.
"Unlike tigers, dragons are so immense, I would never see one in its entirety. But I could explore the mountains, which are the tops of its head."
"These mountains are also like the tops of other dragon heads," the old people would tell me.
When climbing the slopes, I could understand that I was a bug riding on a dragon's forehead as it roams through space, its speed so different from my speed that I feel the dragon solid and immobile. In quarries, I could see its strata, the dragon's veins and muscles, the minerals, its teeth and bones. I could touch the stones the old woman wore, its bone marrow. I had worked the soil, which is its flesh, and harvested the plants and climbed the trees, which are its hairs. I could listen to its voice in the thunder and feel its breathing in the winds. see its breathing in the clouds. Its tongue is the lightning. And the red that the lightning gives to the world is strong and lucky in blood, poppies, roses, rubies, the red feathers of birds, the red carp, the cherry tree, the peony, the line alongside the turtle's eyes and the mallards. In the spring, when the dragon awakes, I watched its turnings in the rivers. The closest I came to seeing a dragon whole was when the old people cut away a small strip of bark on a pine that was over 3,000 years old. The resin underneath flows in the swirling shapes of dragons.
If you should decide during your old age that you would like to live another 500 years, come here and drink 10 pounds of this sap, they told me. But don't do it now. You're too young to decide to live forever.
The old people sent me out into thunderstorms to pick the red cloud herb, which grows only then, a product of dragon's fire and dragon's rain. I brought the leaves to the old man and old woman, and they ate them for immortality. I learned to make my mind large, as the universe is large, so that there is room for paradoxes. Pearls are bone marrow. Pearls come from oysters. The dragon lives in the sky, ocean, marshes, and mountains, and the mountains are also its cranium. Its voice thunders and jingles like copper pans. It breathes fire and water, and sometimes the dragon is one, sometimes many. I worked every day. When it rained, I exercised in the downpour, grateful not to be pulling sweet potatoes. I moved like the trees in the wind. I was grateful not to be squishing in chicken mud, which I did not have nightmares about so frequently now. On New Year's mornings, the old man let me look in his water gourd to see my family. They were eating the biggest meal of the year, and I missed them very much. I had felt loved, love pouring from their fingers when the adults tucked red money in our pockets. My two old people did not give me money, but each year for 15 years, a bead. After I unwrapped the red paper and rolled the bead about between thumb and fingers, they took it back for safekeeping. We ate monk's food as usual. By looking into the water gourd, I was able to follow the men I would have to execute. Not knowing that I watched, fat men ate meat. Fat men drank wine made from the rice. Fat men sat on naked little girls. I watched powerful men count their money and starving men count theirs. When bandits brought their share of the raids home, I waited until they took off their masks so I would know the villagers who stole from their neighbors. I studied the generals' faces, their rank stalks quivering at the backs of their heads. I learned rebels' faces too, their foreheads tied with wild oaths. The old man pointed out strengths and weaknesses whenever heroes met in classical battles, but warfare makes a scramble of the beautiful, slow, old fights. I saw one young fighter salute his opponent, and five peasants hit him from behind with scythes and hammers. His opponent did not warn him. "Cheaters!" I yelled. "How am I going to win against cheaters?"
"Don't worry," the old man said. "You'll never be trapped like that poor amateur. You can see behind you like a bat. Hold the peasants back with one hand and kill the warrior with the other."
Menstrual days did not interrupt my training. I was as strong as on any other day.
"You are now an adult," explained the old woman on the first one, which happened halfway through my stay on the mountain. "You can have children."
I had thought I had cut myself when jumping over my swords, one made of steel and the other carved out of a single block of jade.
"However," she added,